From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Racial balance in public schools. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. 39 years after the death of Dr. Martin Luther King, America is still arguing about how to achieve racial equality. More than a half century after the U.S. Supreme Court outlawed school segregation, the current court is divided over what that means. On To the Point, does the Constitution require that government be colorblind? Or does equal opportunity mandate that race be a factor in school admissions? What's happened in California, Washington State, and Michigan when they have outlawed affirmative action? On Reporter's Notebook later on, nonviolence and the legacy of Dr. King. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Marmon Alney back with To the Point. Dr. Martin Luther King's goal of equal opportunity is still controversial in 21st century America. On To the Point, are race preferences necessary to achieve integration or unconstitutional? We'll look at pending Supreme Court cases that could mean the end of affirmative action. On Reporter's Notebook, how Dr. King made nonviolence a powerful form of protest. First, this news update. In Iraq today, another grisly execution. The government says all legal requirements were adhered to, but the head of Saddam Hussein's half-brother was accidentally severed from his body when he was hanged for the same crimes as Saddam Hussein. Meantime, Iraq's Sunni minority is angry over the president's increase of American troops. Borzu Daragahi reports for the Los Angeles Times. Always good to have you on our program.
It's a pleasure.
The Sunnis supposedly are the beneficiaries of the new plan. It's supposed to be aimed in part at the Shiite militias. Why are the Sunnis angry about it?
Well, I think that there is a part of the Sunni population that grudgingly accepts the prospect of additional U.S. troops, especially if they're used to target Shiite militias that are fighting their communities and harassing their communities. But I think that also the vast majority of the Sunnis, and based on what we're hearing from people, see this as a recipe for increasing the anger of Sunnis and increasing violence against Sunni communities by U.S. troops. U.S. troops continue to conduct most of their operations in Sunni areas, and there's no reason to believe that that will stop.
You have talked to some very influential Sunni leaders. Tell us about those interviews.
Well, I mean, in talking to the Muslim Scholars Association, which is the main clerical umbrella group for the Sunni Friday prayer leaders and imams around Iraq, basically they're saying they vehemently oppose any troop increase. They're saying the only solution is a phase withdrawal. They say they were heartened. They felt very inspired by the Baker-Hamilton report, which argued for a scheduled withdrawal of U.S. troops by 2008. And so they were quite disappointed when word came of additional troops. Although many of the troops will be stationed in mixed Baghdad, at least 4,000 or 5,000 of them will be positioned in Anbar province, which is almost completely Sunni.
The government is, of course, dominated by Shiites, as is, therefore, the military. The Shiite militias are said to be the most powerful force in Iraq after the American troops. Why would the Sunni leaders want to see a withdrawal of American troops?
I think it's quite interesting and, in a way, quite sad because they think that they will basically beat the Shiite militias, that the Sunni insurgents and the Sunni fighters and the so-called honorable resistance in a head-to-head battle with the Shiite militias can win. And if you ask them, well, what if they're getting help from Iran and from other countries, they say, we'll get help from Saudi Arabia and Jordan and other Sunni countries. So it's a recipe for war. Both sides think they can win.
Are the Sunni leaders calling for help from young people throughout the Muslim world?
I think that there is a pressure on the part of some Sunni leaders from their rank and file to issue a fatwa to basically call for more foreign recruits. Already, many of the fighters who've come to Iraq from other countries are Sunni extremists. Many of the people who've been involved in the insurgency are from other countries. There's pressure on them from some of the rank and file to increase the numbers.
Again, we're talking with Borzu Daragahi, the Baghdad bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times. It's also being reported that the American military is having difficulty getting the Shiite government on board. The Prime Minister, Mr. al-Maliki, has appointed a commander for Baghdad that apparently is not well known or very acceptable to the Americans. How does that appear to be going?
I think there's a lot of friction right now between the Shiite-led government and the U.S. forces on the military side. There's a plan underway, soon to be underway, to another plan, yet another plan, to secure Baghdad. And, this time the U.S. officials say it'll work because it's different. There's buy-in on the part of the Iraqi politicians. But if you talk to the Iraqi politicians themselves, there's a lot of skepticism. There's a lot of resentment towards the American military presence. There's a lot of resentment toward what Shiites call, the Shiite-led government calls, American interference and not allowing them to finish the job. And on the other hand, you know, we had U.S. Ambassador Zalmay Khalilzad and the top general, George Casey, today talking, basically papering over those differences, saying everything is hunky-dory.
And very quickly, how soon are the increased troops supposed to arrive in Iraq?
According to Casey, some have already arrived.
All right. And others, of course, will be held longer than they would have been. We'll see, of course, how that deployment is going in days to come. As always, Borzu Daragahi, thanks a lot for being with us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Again, the Baghdad bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times. In a moment, we'll be talking about racial balance in public schools on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. In the 1950s, the U.S. Supreme Court decisions led by Chief Justice Earl Warren provided a legal rationale for the civil rights movement and Dr. Martin Luther King. Key among the court rulings was Brown versus the Board of Education, which outlawed school segregation on the grounds that separate schools were inherently unequal. But there is still dispute about how to achieve equal opportunity. Forced busing is a thing of the past, but racial preferences are still used in many places to accomplish ethnic diversity. Now the U.S. Supreme Court, the current Supreme Court, has been asked to outlaw voluntary affirmative action plans in Seattle, Washington, and Louisville, Kentucky. Andrew Trotter is assistant editor and reporter for Education Week. That's an independent national newspaper that covers K through 12 education. Andrew Trotter, thanks a lot for being with us.
My pleasure.
Tell us, if you will, as briefly as possible for a lay audience, what these plans in Kentucky and Washington State involve and why they're being challenged.
Well, both school districts have decided to try to increase or maintain racial and ethnic diversity in their in every school's population by using race as a factor in assigning students to schools. So that's the main goal there.
What is the term, or how does the term voluntary get applied to this? Who's volunteering to do what?
Well, it's voluntary in the sense that the school districts are not being forced by a court to create a balanced racial population. In the case of one of these school districts, Jefferson County Kentucky, the metropolitan Louisville area, that school district was for many years under a court order. But when the court order was lifted, the school district assembled a similar plan But they did it out of their own choice, and these are elected school board members, so they presumably have the support of the community.
What is the goal? Why do they say they want to accomplish ethnic and racial diversity?
Yeah, school districts in both cities say they are aiming for academic benefits that you get, they say, when you have students of different perspectives and teachers who have to respond to different cultural backgrounds. They also say the world is changing and the workforce is much more diverse and much more international, and being in a broad cultural mix when you're a young person being educated will prepare you for that world.
So they're saying then that the academic benefits accrue not just to minorities traditionally discriminated against who will get equal opportunity, but also to the white students as well, because they need to be exposed to a diverse student body?
Absolutely.
So this is to help everybody then?
That's what they say, yes.
Andrew Trotter again at Education Week. Linda Chavez was staff director of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights during the Reagan administration. She is now chairperson of the Center for Equal Opportunity, nonprofit research organization in Washington, D.C. Linda Chavez, good to have you back on our program.
Good to be with you, Warren.
What's wrong with this?
Well, what's wrong with it is that it is social engineering of the first order. This is not about desegregation. It's not about ending a state-imposed, government-imposed system that kept people out of certain schools because of their color of their skin. In fact, it's in a bizarre way, it's using that kind of racialist thinking and beginning once again to assign students based on skin color, but doing so supposedly not to punish black people, not to keep the races apart, but to force people to go to school together and to maintain what the people who draw up the plans think is some sort of ideal racial balance.
Even though they're not designed to end any current state-imposed system, aren't they justified on the ground that there are still residual characteristics of past state-enforced segregation?
Well, in fact, the Louisville school system had been under a court order for many years, and what these new quotas would do is try to maintain the level of race balancing that occurred at the end of that court-imposed school desegregation plan. But in Seattle, you have an entirely different situation. There is no history of discrimination on the basis of race in the Seattle school system. Students were not, in fact, assigned. School districts were not drawn to be racially exclusive in one way or another. And if you want to give people a maximum of choice, the best way to do it is simply to have an open enrollment system, which is, of course, part of the Seattle plan. The only problem with Seattle is that when a school somehow gets out of balance with, again, what the people who are running the program think is an ideal balance, then they start imposing limits. And so if you're a black student and you want to go to a school that is popular with other black students, once you reach the magic threshold of 60% of the student body being of minority groups, made up of minority groups, then you're no longer eligible to go to that school, even if it's the school you choose and the school your parents choose.
What about the argument that in order to get an education in the United States that will be helpful to one in future life, it's necessary to be exposed to a balance of students that's at least somewhat comparable to society as a whole?
Well, I'm not sure that that is a very valid reason to have state-sponsored racial mixing, the kind of state-sponsored program that really is continuing to judge people by the color of their skin. And in fact, you know, one of the things that is very noticeable about all of these plans is they don't necessarily engage in the kind of balancing that might even be more helpful, which is a socioeconomic balancing, so that students of very different socioeconomic backgrounds might have exposure to each other. School systems, particularly those that are based on neighborhood systems, still tend to be very similar students with parents who have similar education backgrounds and have similar amounts of wealth tend to go to school with each other, and this does not necessarily change that.
Linda Chavez, as formerly staff director of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, now chair of the Center for Equal Opportunity. Gary Orfield is a student of integration in American schools. He's a professor at Harvard University, director of the Civil Rights Project, which is now located at UCLA. Professor Orfield, welcome to you.
Good to be with you.
You are in favor, as I understand it, of the kinds of programs that are being employed in Louisville, have been suspended now in Seattle because of the litigation. Respond, if you will, to the arguments we just heard from Linda Chavez.
Well, I have to differ with Ms. Chavez on almost every point. There is social engineering in this country, and it's basically on behalf of segregation. When you don't have policies that are designed to foster and maintain integration, you get segregation. We've been through 8 or 9 transitions of all the houses in the United States since Brown versus Board of Education, and residential segregation is still pervasive. Almost every city that's ever been sued has been found to have engaged in illegal action in many dimensions. It's not true what she said about Seattle. They were not found to be innocent. They were never tried because they settled the case before it was litigated. But surely if they had examined Seattle, they would have found violations. Almost every American city has violations. But basically,
and those violations have to do with residential? Those violations have to do with residential
pattern? With schools and
with
residential.
The schools. Okay.
Almost all of our cities fostered residential segregation, but almost all of them districted the schools in ways that increased segregation. They located the teachers in places that produced segregation. They created unequal curriculum. They segregated kids within schools. Almost every city that's ever been examined engaged in these practices historically, given the fact that we were a society in which racial discrimination was normal and where we didn't prohibit things like housing and employment discrimination until the 1960s, it's a miracle if a city doesn't have this kind of record. But to go to where we are now, we've been going through resegregation in this country now for more than 15 years since the Supreme Court began to end mandatory desegregation plans across the country, many of which were quite successful. Now we're in the final stage of this, and conservatives are trying to forbid local communities that had very successful integration experiences where the majority of the people want to continue this, and to outlaw any integration in our schools unless it happens by accident. In other words, unless there's stable residential integration, which doesn't happen, or unless a choice system works to produce integration. We tried choice without any desegregation guidelines in literally thousands of school districts under the freedom of choice period in the South that almost never worked to produce integrated schools. We have a record that says that unless we take some conscious action, that we will not get integration on any significant level. We have a record that was supported by 553 social scientists in briefing these cases to the Supreme Court that says integration produces greater educational benefits for minorities and for whites. It also says that it produces better life chances. It shows that where resegregation takes place is almost inevitable if things like this are forbidden, that schools become more unequal and that school districts get schools that are extremely disadvantaged and that will be marked as failures by No Child Left Behind and so forth in very, very rapid order. In Louisville, Kentucky, very large majorities of whites and blacks support maintaining integration. We surveyed the students in the high schools, and we found that 90% on many questions we asked them, of both whites and blacks, by almost identical numbers, said their experience was very positive. The mayor and the business leaders of Louisville have gone to the Supreme Court and said, this has produced a healthy community. It works. It doesn't involve mandating that people go to particular schools. It involves minor controls on a freedom of choice, on a choice system that usually gives families a very high-ranking choice among the choices that they list. Now, there's no system that's perfect, and there's no system that's absolutely fair to everyone. But to say that those communities that want to maintain, continue voluntary integration, where it's been successful, should be forbidden by the federal courts to do what was actually found inadequate by the Supreme Court back in the 1960s, just tells you how far back the extreme right wing is pushing us in as they've gained control of the United States Supreme Court.
Professor Gary Arfield again at Harvard and UCLA. Back to Linda Chavez, formerly with the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. Are, in fact, schools being resegregated? Is that, in fact, inevitable? Do we have to live with it?
Well, first of all, the notion that you can compare this to the supposed freedom of choice plans in the segregated South in the immediate aftermath of Brown versus Board of Education is ridiculous. We are not the same society today that we were 50 years ago. And in fact, integration has happened and it's worked. We have far more integration in all aspects of life today than we did in the 1950s, and certainly a different order of integration that we had in the South, in the Deep South, right after Brown versus Board of Education. So,
but are we moving in terms of school integration backward a bit because of the arguments that Professor Arfield made? Are we more segregated now than we were, let's say, 10 years ago?
Well, what has happened, and Gary Arfield knows this quite well, is that we do have huge changes in our school systems, in part being advanced because of immigration. Many of our school systems today are flooded with lots of new immigrants who tend to come and, as immigrants of every generation, create immigrant enclaves in cities, and they will have an impact on the schools. And because immigrants tend to have more children than native-born Americans, they've had an even more important impact on the school. So if you look at schools in places like Los Angeles, you're going to see, if you go into South Central Los Angeles or East Los Angeles or many different parts of that city, you're going to see school districts in which the overwhelming number of students in those schools are Hispanic, and many of them are newcomers. And that is because people do tend to congregate with people who share something in common, and particularly, as I say, with immigrants, it's a support system that exists for people. They move into a neighborhood where they might have neighbors who come from the same village they do in El Salvador or Mexico. They get jobs because of that. They have a support network there. They find their own foods there. There are lots of reasons that drive people. It is not just racism that drives people to want to live in areas where there are people who are like themselves.
Professor Arfield, quickly, before we have to go to a break, your response, if you will, to this impact of immigration on...
Yeah, immigration is an important issue, and we have had a huge increase in the Latino population in the country, and Latinos, contrary to what Linda Chavez says, are much more segregated than they were a generation ago. And in many cities where desegregation is being stopped, Latinos never even got their desegregation rights that the Supreme Court granted to them in 1973.
Should immigrants, new children, be considered?
Blacks are becoming much more segregated, especially in the South. And there's been a consistent record of increasing integration for blacks in the South from the 1960s to the late 1980s. Now, every year we look at it, in almost every single part of the South, blacks are becoming more segregated.
We're going to take a brief break. As I said, we'll come back. Gary Arfield, we'll let you finish your point. We'll also be talking with Ward Connerly, very active with regard to affirmative action, and Susan Eaton at the Harvard Law School as well on To the Point.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from The Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with To the Point, talking today about school integration since the Brown versus the Board of Education in the early 50s, when the Supreme Court determined that separate schools were not equal. We're still arguing over how to accomplish racial equity here in this country. Professor Gary Arfield, once again, is at Harvard and at UCLA, director of the Civil Rights Project at UCLA. What about this issue of immigrant enclaves that Linda Chavez mentioned, the idea that people live in the same area because they want to be with people who are like themselves? Is that something that schools ought to try to overcome by the assignment of pupils to different schools that have a balance that's more like society as a whole?
Oh, we're really not talking about mandatory assignment of students. We're talking about choice system, about when children choose to go away from their neighborhood, whether the, how we should run that choice system. I believe that, first of all, that very few black or Latino people want to live in a completely segregated setting, less than a tenth by most surveys. There's a huge preference for integration. It's understandable since we show extremely high relationship between school segregation by race and segregation by poverty. And for many Latinos, the schools are segregated by race, poverty, and language. And those schools just don't provide an opportunity. We also find that they have the least qualified teachers, the most limited curriculum, the highest dropout rates, many, many reasons why it's a tremendous disadvantage to be educated in a situation of extreme segregation. I think that the opportunity for children of all races to have a stably integrated middle-class school that they are allowed to go through a choice system is a real minimum standard for civil rights in the society these days.
Would you support the assignment of people on a socioeconomic basis?
Well, you know, I think if Linda Chavez and others would advocate that strongly rather than just oppose desegregation, they'd find plenty of people who would be in favor of having social and economic desegregation in addition to racial desegregation. Because race and class are both problems, they're different problems. For example, middle-class blacks in our studies of metropolitan Boston are likely to live in neighborhoods with many more poor people than poor whites. So if you said only poor blacks could have a choice to go to an integrated school, you'd be excluding a rising middle class, which has systematically unequal educational opportunities to middle class whites. We have to think about both of these issues. I think they're both legitimate questions. What I notice is a tremendous effort by conservative groups to bring down racial desegregation and absolutely minimal effort to do anything about social class segregation. They both need to be done, and basically what I find is conservatives don't really want to do either. They just use one to try to discredit the other, and then they do nothing about the second.
Gary Orfield, again, professor at Harvard and director of the Civil Rights Project at UCLA. Ward Connerly is chair of the American Civil Rights Institute. He's a former regent of the University of California. He has led campaigns to outlaw affirmative action, race preferences in California, in Washington State, and in Michigan, all of which have been successful at the polls. So, Ward Connerly, good to have you back on our program.
Warren, glad to be with you.
What has been the impact in those states as a result of your work?
Well, I think there, in the academic, in the higher education setting, there has been a drop in the number of black and Latino kids at the more selective institutions, more academically selective institutions, because of that academic gap. But I think that is a warning sign, if we didn't need warning beforehand, that something needs to be done within the family structure and within the schools themselves to close the gap. Race should not be the way of solving that problem, just as race should not be used to shuttle these little kids around from one school to another. It's not the extreme right wing, as Mr. Orfield says, that has grown very, very disenchanted with this notion of the government moving people around to achieve some amorphous concept of diversity or this racial mix that they conclude to be so desirable. The jury is very much out as to all these benefits that Mr. Orfield talks about accruing from racial diversity. Howard University and Morehouse University are not terribly diverse with over 90% black kids there, but they sure turn out a good product.
What do you say to Professor Orfield's contention that the research shows that there are correlations, that if there is, in fact, racial segregation, there's also segregation by socioeconomic status as well, that schools that have very high percentages of minority groups in them have poorer teachers, less diverse curricula, less challenging curricula, and so on?
Well, I agree that many of those schools, in fact, most of those schools have inferior quality and the solution should be for us to improve the quality, and many of us, in fact, do that. I spend an awful lot of my time trying to work with nonprofit groups to improve the quality of some of those schools, but I don't think that the solution is that we need to be placing the kids in their settings on the basis of race. Let's solve the problems, which we should have done in the aftermath of Brown versus Board of Education. We should have improved the schools rather than running off on this mission of trying to achieve some concept of racial integration in the schools by busing these kids around and breaking up the schools and separating the parents from their kids. We made some mistakes there, and I think the country is now increasingly becoming aware of that fact.
Brown versus the Board of Education, though, said that separate schools, schools separate by race, are in fact inherently unequal. Wouldn't that be true whether they became segregated due to government intervention or for some other reason?
Well, I don't. I think what we're saying now, though, is that maybe that's not inherently equal. If a school has grown to be more of a percentage of one group rather than another group, but it's a quality school, there's nothing inherently unequal about it. I think the government should not be forcing that. The government should not be creating that separation. I think that's the real lesson of Brown. It's not that black kids have to have white kids sitting next to them in order to get a quality education or for them to learn.
Gary Orfield, professor again at Harvard and UCLA, do you disagree with that? Do you think that Brown versus the Board of Education did say that there is something important about having people of different races sitting next to one another?
Well, Brown versus Board of Education said separate schools were inherently unequal and that they damaged people in an irreversible way. And the Supreme Court reaffirmed that judgment that schools can't really be fully equal and prepare people equally for a interracial democratic society in the University of Michigan cases in 2003. These schools are inherently unequal, not because there's something wrong that's associated with skin color with black people or that they need to sit next to white people, but because we have a society that's systematically unequal on the basis of race. And we tried for more than 60 years to equalize schools under the separate but equal doctrine of the Supreme Court in the Plessy case, 1896. There's no known city where that ever happened. So if there's no case that it's ever happened, pointing to a few individual instances like an individual school in a particular city or the great schools like Spelman and Morehouse, which educate, you know, maybe 0.1% of the African-American college students, that doesn't tell you that this isn't true. Just tells you that there's some cases in which extraordinary efforts can overcome some of the academic deficits that are embodied in extreme poverty, culturally isolated schools with less adequate teaching forces and so forth. We spent more than $100 billion on Title I trying to equalize high-poverty schools. It just hasn't been done on any scale any place in the country yet. That doesn't mean we can stop trying that, or it doesn't mean we shouldn't honor those places that accomplish amazing things in spite of the odds. It does mean there's huge odds against it. And you cannot get prepared for a successful adult life in interracial institutions, in segregated communities and segregated schools. Just a tremendous disability for students of whatever race coming into a society which now has 43% non-white students growing up in it, and where almost all of our children and grandchildren are going to live in very interracial institutions. We either have to make them work and figure out how to live and work together, or we're going to be a society that's much weaker than it could be otherwise.
Ward Connolly, what about that? If there isn't some mechanism for getting people to know each other early on, how are we going to have a society that's truly integrated and where there's equality for all when people grow up?
You know, I love horse racing, and whenever I can find the time, I will frequent the racetrack, and I find myself thrown in with people from all around the globe, low-income people, people who own large chains of restaurants, all sitting next to each other. People are very adaptive. We find a way to get along with others, even when there are barriers of language and whatever. We somehow find a way to get along. And I think it's really nonsense. And I've been a part of that nonsense as well as anyone, as well as others, coming out of the 60s and being an integrationist and believing that because the government had imposed segregation that somehow there were all these benefits for the government to go the other way. I now really sort of recant that view. People are adaptive. They will find ways to get along. And this goofiness that somehow the government has to use race to pull us around here and there in order for us to learn to get along in this global society, I think it's baloney.
Ward Connolly, again, chair of the American Civil Rights Institute, former regent of the University of California, active against affirmative action in California, Washington, and Michigan, where his initiatives have succeeded. I should add that he himself is African-American in origin. Susan Eaton is author of The Children in Room E4. She's a research director of the Charles Hamilton Houston Institute for Race and Justice, also at Harvard Law School. And Ms. Eaton, welcome to you.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Your comment, if you will, on what Ward Connolly said, that people find a way to get along, whether it's at the racetrack or any other place, presuming that they have similar interests and goals.
I think that people will generally find a way to get along to some extent. But I'd like to get back to some of the things that he said. And like Dr. Orfield said, if children aren't brought together in school, it's very difficult to be able to see where in society they're going to learn how to live and work together in a diverse society. And they may be able to get along superficially at the racetrack, but when it comes down to solving complex problems and being equal members of a society sitting on a jury together, I think things get much more complex. In the book that I wrote about, one of the things that I wanted to show in this book was the daily effects of something that we're talking about, which often becomes an abstract issue, that is segregation and concentrated poverty, the very real effects that these two social conditions have upon children's lives. And what I saw in the classroom in the city that I studied was that segregation and concentrated poverty were hugely relevant and hugely damaging to these children's lives. Children who lived in an impoverished corner of Hartford, Connecticut, they had absolutely no firsthand knowledge of what life was like beyond their small corner of at the end of their driveways, for example. And after graduating, Ward Connolly and Linda Chavez were both talking quite eloquently about choices, and I talk a lot in my book about the limited array of choices that the children in this book really have before them. And at their graduation from elementary school, which was a 99.9% black and Latino, two-thirds poor elementary school in a ghetto neighborhood in Hartford, not one of them wanted to attend the segregated, poor, often dangerous, and chaotic middle school they were scheduled to enter the next fall. And many of the parents of these children looked for ways to get their children into a middle school in the working-class suburb that was just over the line from their neighborhood, but to no avail.
Well, now, Ward Connolly has just been saying that the solution to that problem is to improve the schools.
Yes, and in fact, the school that I happened to be in was not one of your typical, poor, disheveled, dilapidated urban elementary schools. This school was actually a school that was given one of those coveted blue ribbons by the U.S. Department of Education under George Bush, and it was named a model for urban education. And I originally went to that school because I thought that it actually could provide us in our increasingly segregated society some sort of model for improved education in our separate and equal society. But what I found was that what was on offer was actually quite appalling. Even though there were many, many heroes in this school, plenty of them, including the teacher who I featured in the book, what was passing for a model for urban education was, generally speaking, the curriculum in the school was not merely driven by the state standardized test, but for the years that I observed this school, the 4 years, the curriculum actually was the test. It was stapled together sample questions from past year's test. It was delivered from the central office, and teachers were mandated to teach. There was no recess in this school, and teachers in this school talked about, quote, sneaking in things like social studies and science.
Well, let me just ask, is this a function of not being able to assign pupils according to their race to various schools?
Yes, I think absolutely the kinds of things that I saw in this school were most definitely direct outgrowths of segregation and concentrated poverty. There's no question about it, because when the school is overrun with the kinds of social problems that concentrated poverty brings into a social institution, teachers and principals had very little choice but to do one thing, and that was to somehow create order in what would otherwise be an extremely chaotic environment. And that's what this school had succeeded in doing. It created order, and then within that very small order, all they did was teach students how to pass a test, and the students passed a test. And when the students passed the test, whether they had recess every day, whether they had physical education or art, whether they knew, you know, whether you were supposed to take a plane or a bus to New York City, which was 80 minutes away, was irrelevant.
And you think had they been schooled together with the same people that are in the wealthier suburbs, they would have had a better sense of life in the world?
Yes. Had they been in a school that was not overwhelmed by concentrated poverty and segregation, if they were in a school with a predominantly middle-class school with some concentration of white students and suburban students and middle-class black students, whatever, if there was more of a mix, the school, yes, would be much more diverse.
Ward Connolly, we're just about out of time, but given the Professor Orfield said earlier, that we're not going to have a perfect system, would the easiest way to accomplish what Susan Eaton says is the desirable goal, what I guess everybody agrees is the desirable goal, would be to simply integrate the schools?
Well, I think that economic integration and social integration may make some sense, but I don't think that race should ever be a factor in doing that. And I have profound respect for Miss Eaton, but the case is still to be made that race is on the same level as economic and social factors.
You don't think racial patterns, some of them ordered by government in the past, have led to the inequalities that we see now?
May very well have, but that does not mean that the government then should go out and reorder the patterns. The government should get the hell out of the way and let people live in their neighborhoods and let the schools form around those neighborhoods. But the government should not be in the business of trying to reorder social patterns.
And Susan Eaton, you believe that the government should be doing that?
I think the government should do more, and because all of these neighborhoods, it's the neighborhood that I wrote about, which the forces can be applied to any, like Gary Orfield said, practically any urban neighborhood in this country. These social forces that created segregation and inequality were in large part government inspired.
Okay.
They were government policies with regard to housing, with regard to zoning, with regard to incentives that allowed middle class people to flee the urban neighborhoods. If you want to talk about social engineering, all of these neighborhoods have been social engineered.
Okay, that's all the time we have. The point certainly is clear that 39 years after the death of Martin Luther King, the issue of racial equality is just as hotly debated as it has ever been. Susan Eaton, author of The Children in Room E4. She's with the Charles Hamilton Houston Institute for Race and Justice at Harvard. Ward Connolly with the American Civil Rights Institute. Gary Orfield at Harvard and UCLA. Linda Chavez, formerly with the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, and Andrew Trotter with Education Week. Thanks all of you very much for being with us today. Familiar images from the civil rights movement include the use of dogs and nightsticks and fire hoses by Police Commissioner Eugene Bull Connor of Birmingham, Alabama. Dr. Martin Luther King insisted that the response of civil rights marchers be disciplined nonviolence. In a moment, how important was that to the success of his movement? How difficult was it? On To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
We're on only back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. America's racial segregation was enforced by decades of police brutality and lynchings and other forms of violence. But the civil rights movement was nonviolent. That was one of the great achievements of Dr. Martin Luther King. According to Bruce Bartlett, he's a conservative columnist who worked in the Reagan and first Bush administrations. His latest book is Imposter, How George W. Bush Bankrupted America and Betrayed the Reagan Legacy. Welcome to our program, Bruce Bartlett.
Happy to be here.
Let's get back to Dr. King and the insistence on nonviolence. You wrote recently in the New York Times about how important this was, how and that we tend to take it for granted. elaborate a bit on that, if you will, and what were the what might have happened had the civil rights movement turned to violence?
Well, I was just kind of thinking about the Middle East and all the violence we see in places like Baghdad and the West Bank and places like that, and it occurred to me that the South of the 1950s and early 1960s could very well have looked, you know, very similar, that we could have had the kind of massive violence down there during the civil rights struggle that we see every day on the televisions. And it seems to me that the reason we don't or didn't is solely because of Dr. King, that he persuaded the advocates of civil rights that nonviolence was a better way to go. And I think that there's still an enormous lesson to be learned from this for peoples around the globe who feel oppressed, and they should learn from Dr. King's lesson.
Elaborate on why you think it could have been so violent, that it could have been comparable to what we're seeing in Baghdad and other parts of the Middle East.
Well, for one thing, the Southern culture that was built up during the years of slavery had been a very violent one. Whites were in the minority in a large part of the South, and they had to use force and violence to maintain the slaveholding system and later the racial superiority system. And there's every reason to think that when that system was threatened, that they would have reacted violently, and it's quite possible that the blacks would have reacted violently as well, and that we could have had, you know, just an absolute bloodbath. Now, of course, a couple people, you know, did die, but I mean, relative to the kind of violent situations we see in the Middle East, it was a very, very peaceable revolution.
People who died were people who were on the civil rights side of the issues,
yes,
Edgar
yes.
Evers and others. How difficult do you think it was for Dr. King not to persuade people not to respond in kind?
Well, it was very hard. I think he spent enormous amount of his time, and I've been reading Taylor Branch's great three-volume history of Dr. King and the civil rights movement. There were a lot of people who were very impatient, and rightly so. And there were people who did advocate violence in the black community. And he spent an awful lot of time trying to convince them that nonviolence wasn't a kind of, you know, wimpy alternative. It was the best alternative. It was the best way to achieve what they wanted to achieve, because It showed the morality of the cause that they were advocating. And, of course, Gandhi and others, and Nelson Mandela and others, have shown the proof of this time and time again. It works. In other words, it's effective. It's not just that you're some kind of, you know, moralistic person. It's the one way of achieving success when you're an oppressed minority that will work.
Bruce Bartlett, once again, served in the Reagan and first Bush administrations, is now a nationally syndicated columnist. In your piece in the New York Times, you refer to the fact, and perhaps it came from Taylor Branch's book, that Dr. King actually chose to go to Birmingham, Alabama, for reasons that have to do with what we're discussing. Elaborate on that.
Well, I was referring there mainly to his famous letter from Birmingham jail, where he talks about I forget the exact terms he used, strategic confrontations or whatever, that he went to Birmingham because he knew that Bull Connor was going to react to the peaceful demonstrators with violence. And if they were to react with violence themselves, they would undermine their cause. But if they stuck firmly to nonviolence and allowed the police to react the way they did, and many of us remember those images on television, it would greatly empower the civil rights movement, and it did. It created massive amount of empathy in the North and basically won the victory for the civil rights movement. Very shortly after the Birmingham campaign, in which Dr. King and others were arrested and things of that sort, John F. Kennedy finally put forward a civil rights bill that eventually was enacted the following year, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which really brought, you know, did more to advance the civil rights cause than any other legislation since Reconstruction.
We just have a couple of seconds left, but you point out in your column that perhaps the Palestinians could have adopted similar tactics if they'd been able to and accomplished something similar. Do you really believe that's the case?
Well, look, these people are obviously willing to kill themselves anyway, and I'm just suggesting if they did it in a nonviolent way, they would gain a lot more sympathy for their cause than they get by going around killing innocent civilians at the same time.
Nonviolence, one of the great achievements of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., whose birthday we celebrate today. Bruce Bartlett, as always, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you.
Nationally syndicated columnist, formerly with the Reagan and first Bush administrations. Today's program produced by Dan Konicki with Katie Cooper and Vanessa Romo. Our technical director is Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at kcrw.com/To The Point. I'm Warman Olney. Join us again for To The Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.